not Thursday, March 12th, is it?
Today is the 12th, yes.
It's Tuesday.
April 12th.
I'm sorry, April 12th, yes.
Tuesday, April 12th, about 1:40 in Betty's room, and we're going to hear, first of all, committee substitute for Senate Bill number 347, Labor and Commerce. You'll recall we had a committee substitute incorporating the changes made on the House side as they've been working through the bill. We've made one additional change, which is to make an effective date of July 1, 1995. It puts off the tax question until next year when it will become clearer, I think, what in the future the state of Alaska is going to hold. And also, it's a new entity, and it probably should have some breathing room, give people time to look at it and what it means to doing business in Alaska. So is there a motion to adopt the committee substitute? Senator Sharp?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would move that we adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 347, Labor and Commerce, the old version.
Okay, is there any objection? No objection. We have adopted the CS. Is there a motion to move the bill? Senator Sharp?
Mr. Chairman, I would move CS for Senate Bill 347, Labor and Commerce, out of committee with individual recommendations.
Okay, without objection, committee substitute for Senate Bill 347, Labor and Commerce, moved from committee. That brings us to House Bill 358, Mobile Home Certificates of Title. Patrick, go ahead. Want to identify yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Patrick Lounsbury. I'm here to speak on HB 358, an act allowing a mobile home owner to request a certificate of title from the Department of Public Safety. This bill became necessary when the legislature passed SB 99 last year, the governor's omnibus fee and cost reduction bill, which repealed the DMV's authority to issue mobile home titles. Without a title, there's no way of knowing for certain that the person selling the mobile home is the legal owner or whether or not the owner has a right to sell without paying off a lien holder. This lack of documentation has opened up a can of worms for the owners, sellers, lending institutions, and the like. All parties involved are in agreement that they themselves should pay an appropriate fee to cover the cost of maintaining a title system. This bill simply gives back to the owners and industry the tool they need to facilitate honest transactions. Are there any questions?
Just some background to the committee. When this bill passed last year, we had actually discussed this in the Finance Committee, and we sort of let it drop through the cracks. And we had a meeting with some of the owners and the bankers in Anchorage during the interim, and they suggested the legislation. So. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Josh?
I should note that in the packets there are two fiscal notes. One of the fiscal notes should not be from the House. And it would be version number one would be the fiscal note. I believe the committee would want to move that. It shows the accurate $100 title fee and the correct number of titles per year, which is 2,500. Yeah. Version two was corrected and it would not apply to this bill. As written.
So version two is out.
Right.
Version one is the one we want to send forward. Would you see that that happens?
Yes.
It shows revenues of $250,000, expenditures $140,000. We made money on this one. Okay. Is there a motion?
Sure.
Senator Sharp?
Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate Bill or House Bill 358, CS for House Bill 358, State Affairs, out of committee with individual recommendations, and fiscal note version one.
Without objection, the bill moves. Senate Bill 313. Who is here for Senator Cordova?
Contact their office, Mr. Chairman.
Here's the girl, sir.
Oh,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Carol. I work with Senator Curtula. Thank you for letting me be here today. Senate Bill 313 is some amendments to Senator Curtula's high-risk health insurance bill that was passed in 1992. The amendments were requested by the association that the high-risk health insurance association that was set up at that time. What the amendments do are, number one, they include within the organizations any health maintenance organizations or other managed care entities that may develop within the state of Alaska. One of the requirements of the insurance bill is that each member of the industry be a member of the association in order to do business in the state. Therefore, if health maintenance organizations are included here, then they will be able to participate in the high-risk health insurance pool. Section 3 and 4 of the bill provide additional forms of deductibles, copayments, and maximums. This amendment does not change the requirement to offer a policy with the original limitations, but does respond to requests by residents seeking only catastrophic insurance with high deductibles. This change enables the Director of Insurance to respond to this type of request. Section 5 broadens the ability of the association to offer policies to groups that maintain healthy lifestyles without changing the basic requirements that premium rates be based on age and geographic location. This amendment will enable the association to offer non-smokers, for example, a lower premium rate. Section 6 further defines eligibility for the state plan. This section would disqualify those residents who were eligible to be covered by a plan subject to the Small Employer Health Reinsurance Association, and states that when a resident moves out of state, they cannot renew or purchase insurance from the association, but they get to keep their existing policy until it lapses. Section 7 and 8 require payment of the premium with the request or the application. At the present time, the association has to bill. Section 9 explicitly gives the association director or the director of insurance the ability to formulate policy and adopt regulations. Section 10 provides a member of the board of the association with immunity from civil or criminal liability for an act or omission in good faith and within the scope of the director's duties. This is especially important to the public members of the board to protect them from lawsuits when the director of insurance has acted in good faith in fulfilling his duties. Section 11 essentially allows the director to accept an application for coverage in cases where two denials of coverage seem to be superfluous. Presently, an applicant is required to be rejected by two insurance organizations before they can apply for the association, and this amendment would allow the director to list those some disabilities that are recognized as being high risk before they have to go to an insurance company and be rejected. Mr. Robert Niebrugge, who is the public member of this association, is on teleconference from Glen Allen, and if you have any real detailed questions, he would be willing to answer those.
Any questions? Go ahead.
Yeah, Carol, I'm just curious as to how many people have taken advantage of this high-risk insurance since the original enactment of the legislation.
I believe there's 70 people that are in the pool at this time.
And will this change in it expand that number, in your opinion?
According to the association, they think that it will, especially the catastrophic type insurance, because there have been people that have wanted it, but only at that type, and then that makes the cost of the premiums pretty low. They're willing to take on more.
If I were to ask you about the premiums, you wouldn't really be, I mean, they vary, I assume, mm-hmm. with age and...
Well, I did get a schedule or kind of a list of what, pardon me, a range. For example, this is proposed major medical rates for 93. If one was to have a deductible of $2,500 and you were like 35 to 39, your monthly premium would be $169. I believe that's what this, Mr. Niebrugge.
Thank you.
Further questions? We have a group of folks in Fairbanks. Did you want to testify on the bill in Fairbanks? Hello Fairbanks.
I'm not sure what the problem is.
This is Fairbanks.
Did you have some people that wanted to testify?
Yes.
Go ahead.
My name is Brenda Evans, and I'm a 45-year-old white female. I reside in Fairbanks with my husband, John. I'm a full-time student at UAS in junior standing. I'm a diabetic in renal failure, and if this will necessitate dialysis and kidney transplant in the future. I have no medical insurance except student insurance, which covers no pre-existing conditions. I'm not on any government-sponsored program or Medicaid. I also have not had a physician, primary care physician, since October of this last year and have not been able to find a doctor to take my case care.
Okay. We also have, I understand, Rudy Vetter, Vicki Lottie, and Sybil Skelton. Let me ask if they're all in favor of the legislation.
Yes.
Okay, and then in Anchorage we have Bonnie Nelson, Thelma Walker, and Nina Magnuson, and are they all in favor of the legislation?
Yes.
Okay. Well, to be real, you know, honest about it, folks, I think we probably have enough information to move the bill on. Did anybody in the room want to testify? And once again, how is this pool being financed? Is it by a percentage of premiums sold in the state, or?
Mr. Chairman, it is being financed through premiums and assessments to the insurance companies that write business in the state.
Okay. There is no state money going into this particular program?
No, there is not.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? What's the role of the committee? Senator Salo.
Thank you. I move that Senate Labor and Commerce move up Senate Bill 313 with individual recommendations.
Okay.
Along with the fiscal note.
There is a motion. Is there any objection? Without objection, bill moves from committee with individual recommendations. I have lost my agenda sheet.
Good. Used to gavel.
Yeah.
Okay. House Bill 54, telephone caller identification block. Josh, didn't we do some work on this bill?
Yeah.
Where did Josh go?
I have the bill.
Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee, my name is Dan Austin. I'm Legislative Assistant to Representative Kay Brown. Representative Brown regrets the House committee business prevents her from appearing before you today. She has asked me to present House Bill 54 to the committee and to answer any questions you may have. Since the committee last considered HB 54, Representative Brown has worked with the Alaska Telephone Utilities and other interested groups to prepare the version of the bill that is before you, I think, as a committee substitute. Briefly, House Bill 54 provides that if a telephone utility offers the feature known as caller ID to its Alaska customers, it shall also offer the customer the choice of not having their number or other identification revealed by that feature. This is known as call blocking or line blocking. The most important issue involved is that of privacy and its impact on facilities such as domestic violence shelters, and we have representatives of those shelters here to testify before you if you so wish. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Okay, Josh, what were the changes there?
Mr. Chairman, in the CS, in the original bill, there was a strict prohibition, or just a simple prohibition against the telephone company from charging a fee for providing caller block. This bill allows that continues to be a prohibition for the initial caller block, but if they cancel caller block, then once again, there can be a fee for the second or any subsequent installation of caller block. It can only be a one-time fee. It cannot be a recurring fee, monthly fee. And and that is agreeable to the Alaska Telephone Association. I know Senator Sharp discussed it with Representative Brown, and it was agreeable to those parties.
Okay. Is there any opposition to the bill now?
None that I'm aware of, Mr. Chairman. Everyone I've talked to is sees this as a compromise piece of legislation and is on board.
Okay. In that case, what's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we report out the Senate CS for... we should adopt Senate CS for CS for House Bill number 54, Labor and Commerce, which is the Kramer version 22894.
Without objection, that is adopted. Before you make the motion, Dan, is Kay satisfied with this version? She's not going to try to amend it?
Yes, I believe Representative Brown is satisfied.
I'd move that we report out the Senate Labor and Commerce CS for House Bill 54 with individual recommendations.
Without objection, committee substitute. Senate committee substitute. Committee substitute. Report out of the committee.
Thank you.
Okay, House Bill 403.
Here's the list.
Automotive liability insurance coverage. Royce?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Royce Weller, an aide to Representative Hudson. In your packet, you should have the sponsor statement and the backup information. Representative Hudson apologizes for not being able to be here today. They're on the floor, as you know. Mr. Chairman, just a short statement about the bill. The best method of assuring Alaska consumers of competitive auto insurance premiums is to have a marketplace which encourages competition. A greater number of insurance companies doing business in Alaska will ensure a more competitive premium in all areas of insurance coverage. House Bill 403 was introduced to encourage this competitive marketplace by not mandating unreasonable insurance coverages. Current law requires all insurance companies offering auto liability coverage to provide coverage up to $1 million per person for bodily injury or death of one person and $2 million per accident for bodily injury or death for more than one person. No other state mandates a company to offer such uninsured or underinsured motorists higher than the driver selects for himself. In fact, no other state mandates even the minimum levels of coverage we have here in Alaska, and there is an attached sheet in the packet to review. House Bill 403 removes the mandatory offering of $1 million to $2 million by amending AS 2189-02OC to require coverage that includes policy limits equal to the amount voluntarily purchased to cover the insured's liability for bodily injury or death. Since records show virtually no one opts for the high Alaska uninsured or underinsured motorist limits, and Alaska's minimum limits are twice the amount in any other state, these changes contained in this bill are very reasonable. Nothing precludes any motorist, however, from purchasing any level desired, but this bill now removes the mandated offer. HB 403 has the support of the Division of Insurance and the Alaska Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers, and contains a zero fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Donnelly, did you want to testify on this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I understand that the position of the division is neutral, unless that they were formally supporting this, but they have taken a neutral position on the legislation at this time. There's a lot of good reasons for allowing consumers this option. You know, we talk a lot about personal responsibility, and we want the citizens of Alaska to take that responsibility. This bill gives them the option to do that. What we're talking about here is uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage, which is first-party insurance. This is insurance that you buy to protect yourself and your family from damages caused by underinsured or uninsured motorists on the highways. It's part of a package that I think is important to our mandatory auto insurance laws. we don't require ordinary drivers to show proof of insurance up front in this state. That's the way most states do it. Now, we all know that the insurance industry strongly opposes mandatory auto insurance. They have for years. They fought it bitterly. They blocked it in this state for years. But at the same time, 80 to 85% in the polls of Alaskans support mandatory auto insurance. And I think we've proven since its adoption in 1984, and we did have a gap there when it expired for a while, that it's been a very successful program in the state. One of the unique things about Alaska, though, is you don't show proof of insurance up front. And part of that is that you're going to have some people falling through the cracks more here than in other states. With the type of voluntary program we've got a real good record as far as keeping the uninsureds down. It's about 11% is some of the estimates, about half of what it was before the law. But you should give people, the consumers, the choice to protect themselves from those folks out there. It keeps these people, it allows consumers the choice to protect themselves and keeps them out of the system where we would have to subsidize their losses they incurred because they didn't have adequate insurance, because they would just fall into the social service system or the health care service and raise costs for everybody else. The specific problem that's occurred here is that some less preferred companies that do a smaller amount of the market, who specifically deal with high-risk drivers, have a difficulty getting reinsurance for this type of coverage. That's been the reason specifically articulated for this need here, that there's a problem saying that some of these companies who do insure less preferred drivers have a problem because they're smaller companies, and this is an unusual requirement, so that standard underwriters or reinsurance companies see this and are concerned about it, as we found it over time is real common in the insurance industry. Anything unusual is a big problem, and they don't want to reinsure. And these people, since they don't have the facility to reinsure, have less of a tendency to do business in Alaska. I think this can be rectified not by taking away the choice for all consumers, because you haven't seen State Farm or Allstate or National here today saying they've got a problem, because they don't have this reinsurance problem because they reinsure themselves. Why should we take this choice away from all consumers when it's just a problem for certain consumers? I don't think that's a wise choice. What you can do, and what this bill should have done from the beginning, in my opinion, is focus in on where the problem is. And the problem's with the assigned risk drivers, people who are in assigned risk pools, the SR-22 folks. I would support removing this mandatory option from those folks, saying that that the provisions in this bill would apply just to the people who are in the assigned risk pools now. That would remove them from because the vast majority of the business written by the companies that have a problem with this are with the assigned risk pool people. That would remove their problem and allow them to return, allow them to do business in the market just like they do other places. That would preserve the choices for the 60 or 70% of Alaskan drivers who are good, real good drivers, preferred risks, and remove it for those folks who are not good drivers. And that seems real rational to me, because it'd be just part of the penalty for not having a good driving record or not being a desirable risk in driving. That seems like a rational enough choice, and still preserve the options for the vast majority of Alaskans that this hasn't created a problem with. Now, the argument about people haven't been electing to do this, I really want to do some research into how people are educated when they go and buy auto insurance. I'm wondering, maybe the five of you on the panel remember last time you bought auto insurance, and whether you really got a real primer on your options of what was available to you. And I'd love to spend some time with the committee going over what your specifically policies are like, because I would bet that I found that probably 60, 70% of the people I talk to that have a considerable risk factor, and you've got assets, you've got a family, you've got a home, are probably underinsured as far as your risk from uninsured or underinsured motorists out there. And I think it'd be an interesting exercise to go through that review, and I wonder how many of you each know exactly how much underinsured and uninsured motorists you have. It's not the common thing that an ordinary consumer thinks of off the top of their head, but it ought to be the kind of thing that brokers or agents educate their consumers on, because it's a real important factor.
I bought my policy
Exactly. And you might be able to save a lot of money if you were to take the time. And it takes time. Believe me, it was real complicated. I just changed companies, and it literally took me, I bet I put up to 20 hours into examining the rates of different companies, examining the structure of the insurance, and seeing what the best buy was. And we found, especially in the UMUI area now, that because of a uninsured and underinsured, that's what it's called in the business, the UMUI. Okay. Sorry about that. Some companies are 4 or 5 times the rates of other companies. I mean, by shopping around, you can make a big difference right now in this marketplace.
Where did you end up getting yours?
I ended up with State Farm. I was with Allstate, but what happened was last year Allstate had 3 catastrophic losses in their UMUI, or several years ago, and their UMUI is now like 5 times as much as State Farm. And you get exact same coverage for 1/5 the price, essentially. And you can do that just by shopping around. And that's what this is really all about. It gives the consumer some choices here. But once again, I see some of the problems this has created, and it's especially noticeable in the assigned risk drivers. So once again, I say that the way to solve this problem is exempt out the assigned risk drivers from this mandated offer, and maybe change that part of the existing law that mandates, that seems to have been read to require this repeated offer, that there's a letter from Alaska National saying they don't want to have to send this letter out every time. There's a reason they're doing it, because at the time we adopted this law, we wanted to try to educate consumers about this. And about the only way to do that is to kind of force feed people and say, here it is. Do you want to turn this down? Do you want to make the conscious decision you don't want this coverage? Because otherwise, people, just a very typical thing for the average insurance agent in the state is somebody calls up and says, I want the minimum insurance I'm required to have by law. And the agent may or may not try to convince them, you know, that, well, look, you realize that won't protect you. That just protects other people. And if you want to protect your family, you may want to consider having this or that. There may be people that already have a disability policy and a good medical policy that may not have the need for underinsured and uninsured. But folks who don't may have a real important need for this type of insurance.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
Did you say that the insurance industry is against mandatory auto liability insurance?
Absolutely.
Why would that be?
In fact, in my latest, about 3 or 4 times a year, I get a little flyer from State Farm. Used to get one from Allstate, update on political issues, just general issues. Almost every one of them's got a little blurb against mandatory auto insurance in it. And I know the average person just finds this incomprehensible, but it's an absolute fact. And the only good arguments I've ever been able to ascertain for this is that when you have mandatory auto insurance, a lot of people who are lousy risks are forced to get insurance. And that, through the assigned risk market and the pooling arrangements, tends to make it more difficult for everybody. And it's just part of the public policy call in spreading out the risk across the society so that some people just don't get catastrophic injuries. There's something available out there for almost everybody. And they don't like that. It's a hassle. They don't really want to insure those people. Also, when somebody does not have insurance and gets in an accident, I've also heard the argument from larger insurance companies that it makes them look bad. That the public gets mad when somebody's uninsured, and they hold it against the whole insurance industry as a whole, not just against the person who broke the law and didn't get the insurance. So that absolutely, firmly, nationally, the major insurance providers are opposed to mandatory auto insurance.
If I can follow up. In our present situation, you know, the kind of the one free accident rule, are they against, I mean, is that a complexity that they would rather have than straight mandatory liability insurance, or do they have a position between those two?
Well, what we do, we have a one free accident enforcement rule. It's not a total one free accident rule. Some states have parallels. They're financial responsibility laws. We say that you must have insurance on any automobile you register in the state that you're operating on a state road. That's the law. If you don't get it, you're in violation of the law. You get caught, you're subject to the penalties for that. Now, we don't require proof of insurance up front, but at the time you register that vehicle, you have to sign a statement saying that anytime you operate that, you're going to have insurance. So we actually have a mandatory law that simply doesn't require proof of insurance up front, as a lot of law, you know, states do. Probably the majority of states require that up front. Then we also have the financial responsibility provisions that say if you are in an accident and you don't have the insurance, if you can't show proof of insurance, then we're going to suspend your license or until you do show proof of insurance. And for future times, when you go to register an automobile, you're going to have to show proof of insurance. And that's called an SR-22 filing. You hear a lot about that. That's an assigned risk pool thing. It requires that insurance companies notify the state if somebody cancels their policy. These are people who have proven they broke the law or have been drunk driving or have proven they're a risky driver, and we want to, and they're the people that we now track and make sure that they maintain an insurance policy.
Okay. All right, thank you, Dave. John?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John George. I'm here today representing the National Association of Independent Insurers. First, let me agree with Senator Donnelly that insurance companies would prefer not to have to take all comers, all the bad drivers, and would like to write the better drivers. That's where they can do business the most effectively. But as in most other states, there is an assigned risk market where someone who cannot buy insurance in the voluntary market can go and absolutely be assured of finding insurance coverage, and that is an appropriate mechanism for that type of insurance. But there are all sorts of automobile insurance companies, and some try and get only the preferred risks, plus they take their assignments in the assigned risk plan. There are some that target less than perfect drivers, young drivers or people with specific types of cars or someone who's only had one drunk driving ticket instead of three. And because they target that market, they know how to underwrite properly. They charge more for it because there is more of a risk, and they seem to be able to do so profitably also. The underinsured motorist problem, though, is really somewhat, as Dave said, a problem because of reinsurance. Now, most insurance companies do not, for their own account, insure the entire risk. Let's say you were going to write a policy with a $5 million limit. Well, an insurance company to write a lot of $5 million limit policies would have to have a lot of capital and surplus. But by only taking for their own account maybe $50,000 of that risk and then reinsuring with other companies the remainder, and maybe not just one company, but they may have a string of insurance companies taking different layers of that excess risk, they're able to pass it off, spread the risk around, and effectively a company can write a high limit policy with only retaining a small amount for themselves.
How a cookie works.
The what?
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, insurance probably has some in common with that, with a bookie operation also. The problem that insurance companies faced in Alaska, and several basically had to withdraw because they were either unable or unwilling to buy reinsurance specifically for Alaska to cover this particular risk, when throughout the entire nation they may write maybe a $500,000 limit is the biggest policy they write. So they buy reinsurance for $450,000, excess of the $50,000 they want to retain for their own account, to go out and buy special reinsurance to cover the uninsured, underinsured motorist policy only for Alaska. And then it would only cover those few policies where the policyholder opted for the higher limits. And while there certainly are some people that opt for those limits, there just are not all that many. So it has become a problem. There are three or four companies that have ceased to do business in Alaska just because it was not a viable thing for them to do to buy specific reinsurance for that, and they were not able to retain the entire million, 2 million for their own account. So we feel that competition would improve some if this law passes and those limits are reduced. Also, as a matter of sort of the golden rule of do unto others as you would have them do unto you. If you buy, let's say, 100, 300 limits of liability coverage to protect the other guy if you run over him, then it would seem that you ought to at least be able to buy that kind of limit, essentially, to cover you if he runs over you and has no insurance. To buy higher limits in the event that he hits you instead of you hitting him, you know, maybe somewhat out of balance. So we encourage people to buy higher limits. Certainly, Alaska has the highest minimum limits, but they're certainly not adequate. I mean, we can all think of incidents where the minimum limits wouldn't begin to cover the entire cost, and yet 99% of all accidents probably do fall within the minimum limit that's required in Alaska. So there are some trade-offs. It's a policy call for the legislature, and I think that's, you know, really where we are at this point. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is there anyone else to testify on this bill? Please come forward and state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Howard Jaeger, and I'm an insurance producer with Shattuck and Grumman Agency here in Juneau, and I'm here today on behalf of the Alaska Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers. And let me point out to you that we are not the insurance companies. We're the retailers. We're guys that sell the products that the insurance companies make available to us. We're our customers are your constituents, and these are the people we're here and talking about. And why we are in support of this bill. We want to point out that this bill will not preclude insureds from buying the higher limits. They can still do that. Alaska has the mandatory liability limits, which are 50, 100, and 25, and most companies offer higher limits than that already without it being mandatory. And this could be the same way with this uninsured motorist coverage. It doesn't have to be mandatory in order for the companies to offer it. So the people would still have a choice. They would still have a choice if they wanted to buy the higher limits of liability of uninsured motorist and underinsured motorist coverage if they wanted to. And that's what we're talking about. His is a choice, an option. Now, a lot of the people, it's been said here something about the assigned risk plan. A lot of people are not in the assigned risk plan. They may be into another specialty carrier. Colonial Insurance Company writes a lot of business in Alaska, which is a specialty carrier for the not preferred driver. Progressive Insurance Company is another one. And these folks are the ones that are taking the youthful drivers, the driver that maybe doesn't have the DWI but is borderline. And it gets to be an economic issue with the customer, the person that's sitting across the table from me. When it gets down to the bottom line on this coverage and the limits and the availability, it's an economic issue with them. It's been stated already that Alaska has the highest mandatory auto liability limits in the nation. That has an impact on cost to the consumer. And I mean, you can talk to my children that are in their early 20s, and sometimes the difference between buying a stereo or buying an auto insurance policy is a real problem for them to come up with the bucks to do both, and so maybe one or the other has to go. And that's what we're talking about here, is that Alaska consumer that needs to have that choice. One of the things we think that this could do is to perhaps make more choice available to the constituents in Alaska. Perhaps we could get another company or two to come in here and offer their coverage and be competitive, but right now that million, 2 million offering is holding them back.
Let's see, we have a list here that says that Alaska's liability rate is 5,125.
Yes.
Was that put in legislation, Dave, several couple years ago? And then we also have a list of the other states, and it is considerably higher than the rest of the states.
No doubt it is. You know, Allstate and State Farm are big or huge or whatever you want to call them insurance companies. It doesn't appear that this million, 2 million limit is bothering them at this point. There may be a difference in rates, and maybe it was said that three catastrophic losses for Allstate drove up their uninsured motorist rates. Well, probably what's going to happen, that's going to flip-flop, and pretty soon State Farms will be going up again. That's the nature of the business. That's what happens in the insurance business. They're each taking a risk, and that could happen next year that you may be looking back at a difference in premium again. A notice is sent to the insurers, to my knowledge. A notice is sent to these insureds on their renewal time that tells them that higher limits of uninsured motorists are available. When a customer comes into our office, we have a sheet that shows the limits that are mandatory offered in the law. If someone wants the higher limits, we can quote them the higher limits and give them that choice of what they want. It becomes an economic issue, and I can't point that out to you enough, that is a very, very real economic issue with these people. In fact, I don't have the numbers. In fact, I don't know where they come up with 11% uninsured drivers in Alaska. I'd be interesting to see where those statistics come from. But I can tell you that there are many, many young and youthful drivers out there that are buying no uninsured motorist coverage because the law provides that they can opt out of it. They can check the box that says, no, I don't want uninsured motorist coverage, and it's an economic issue again. That's the reason they're doing it.
Do you have an option not to buy it?
They have an option not to buy. That's correct, and there are lots and lots and lots of youthful drivers that are doing that because of cost. I think that does it for me now.
Okay.
Thank you.
Maybe the department did best to ask, is there an estimate of how many uninsured drivers we have in the state of Alaska does uninsured for their own liability, which would drive the cost of this?
Public safety, as I understand it, tells us about 11%. That's the, I don't know where they get that information from.
Well, I thought you said 11% didn't have the uninsured drivers.
No, uninsured, no insurance at all, period.
No insurance.
Yeah.
Seems low to me. I think there's that many driving around with no license, driver's license.
Well, sir, I'll tell you, if you look at the statistics and read the paper, you see a lot of people in accidents or picked up for DWI. They not only don't have insurance, they don't have a driver's license.
Can you get auto insurance if you don't have a driver's license?
No, sir.
If you were to lose your driver's license, does the insurance company cancel your coverage? If you lose your driver's license, do they cancel your coverage?
Yes.
Is there some mechanism so that you don't have to call them and say, I've lost my license? Does DMV or something notify insurance companies? Is there a list that goes around of people that lose their licenses?
No. Mm-mm. Generally, what happens is the people, if they get picked up for a DWI, for instance, and they come in and want to get their driver's license back, and that's the kicker. They need the SR-22 to go to the Department of Safety to get their driver's license.
And what's the SR-22?
That's a form number. SR-22 has to do with the financial responsibility. And in the law, that's the form, the state of Alaska form, not an insurance company form, that they that the insurance company has to provide to public safety in order to give the people their license back.
That just tells that they're insured.
That tells that they are insured. Has nothing to do with uninsured motorist on that form, however.
Further questions? Georgina?
I did. Go back to, please, the youth, the statement that you made, the youth, the box that they check off.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me again what that is.
The law says that we have to offer uninsured motorist limits of up to $1 million, $2 million. And you can take whatever limits you want to choose, or you can say, I don't want any coverage. I don't want any underinsured or uninsured motorist coverage, whether you're youth or you or I. We could say, no, I don't want that coverage and not have to buy it.
Okay, thank you. Michael Lesmeyer. Lesmeyer.
Shattuck's daughter's my landlord. Mr. Chairman, my name is Michael Lesmeyer. I'm a lawyer here in Juneau. I'm here on behalf of State Farm. We just have a couple of comments about this bill. One of the concerns that we have about the present system, and we have worked with Senator Donnelly, I think, back to 1983 when we talked about mandatory insurance in Alaska, and we ended up with a scheme that we have, which, by the way, is working very well. I think 11%, if you were to look nationwide for uninsureds, is very, very good. And one of the difficulties with mandatory insurance, Senator Rieger, is that no matter what sort of form you adopt, there are certain categories of people that you cannot force them to buy insurance no matter what you do, and those are the categories of people that operate on suspended license, et cetera. So we're doing pretty good. The uninsured and underinsured motorist provisions that we have in the law today were part of that ultimate package to guarantee that people would be able to be protected, and so this guarantees them a choice. The concern we have about this is we have to do a mandated offer at every single renewal. So every 6 months for our policyholders, we have to offer it again, whether they've chosen to decline it or not. We think that we ought to be able to offer it once, and if they decide they want it later on, they can come talk to us and we'll sell it to them. That's the first concern that we have. And I realize with Senator Donnelly that he's concerned about educating people, and I don't think you educate them by simply repeating the same information. Many of them don't read it anyway. I think you have to rely on the ability of the agent to educate them at the outset. Or you have to rely on their responsibility as adults to call the agent up and ask to discuss it with them. The second concern we have is simply the concern that was mentioned by John George, and that is that philosophically, we would prefer that the mandated offer be equal to the amount of liability coverage that they choose to purchase. In other words, should we be required to offer them more for themselves than they choose to purchase for the protection of the other people, and we think not. We would just tell you parenthetically that the higher limits are sold virtually never. I think here in Juneau, I was talking to our agents a couple of weeks ago, and they maybe have sold one of those policies. So it's not something that comes up very often.
Well, if this legislation was passed, would somebody still be able to purchase $1 million or $2 million if they chose to?
I don't know the answer to that. I think that as long as there is a market demand for it, you know, competition would make that available. But I cannot tell you the answer for that.
Dave, do you have an answer to that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The passage of this would not affect the availability. It would just affect whether there was a mandated offer.
Dave?
But it would in another way. And an example of that, and State Farm is real familiar with this. Before 1984, there was no requirement in the state that there be an offer of underinsured motorist coverage. We had only what was called uninsured motorist coverage. State Farm did offer underinsured motorist coverage at that time, but they were the only company who did so. The reason no other companies did that, even though they actually did want to offer that, they were afraid by being the only company in the market offering that, or being one of a few companies, they got all the excess liability. In other words, whenever there was an accident, because they were the only folks that had a policy that covered that kind of exposure, they ended up paying it, even if another policy was primary. And by making it a uniform requirement, then everybody goes to the market at the same time, you eliminate this concern about excess liability. So you do have that. That was a deterrent to us originally getting coverage in an open market for underinsured motorist coverage. And that's been a big success, I think. Once you mandated it, it was offered throughout the marketplace and it didn't have that problem.
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. I think the way this works together with the mandatory insurance has been good for the Alaska consumer. We just think it's gone a little bit too far. And I think that's the purpose of this legislation.
Where does this say in this bill that it's mandated that you have to offer this every 6 months?
This bill would correct that and say we only have to offer it once. In the law, it says at the time of the renewal in the present law. So presently, we have to do it every single time.
I have a question of the bill when you get through with the testimony, I guess.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, Dave, how did the division insurance go from supporting, we support the revision that would remove the mandatory offer of higher limits to a neutral position?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is David Walsh. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance. The administration has not taken a formal position on the bill. We issued that letter, and the administration then decided they were not going to take a position on the bill, at least at this time. So we are officially neutral on the bill.
Okay. Anybody else in Anchorage want to testify? Anybody else here want to testify?
Dave?
Yes, Senator.
Why are you remaining neutral?
The administration has not yet taken a position on 403, so we have no choice but to be neutral on the bill.
No position taken?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'm sure there is, but I don't know what it is.
This is the third floor you're talking about.
Yes.
Okay. Anybody else want to testify today? We're done.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to initially say I really appreciate the comments of the folks from the industry. I think basically they're right on, real accurate. Things that I would like the committee to remember, though, the one area where I philosophically disagree with them, and it's strictly a philosophical argument, is this argument that you should only be allowed to purchase as amount to protect you and your family as much as you protect other people. Well, Mr. Chairman, each one of us has individual risks. I mean, you might have a family with 9 children that would require a lot more support than a person who is a single individual. And this would deny you that flexibility to adjust your first-party protection, your UMUI, to protect what you assess as your own personal risk. That's why that makes sense philosophically to me, and that's why the argument say you should only be allowed to protect yourself as much as you protect other people doesn't necessarily make sense, because that applies to people who are single, and also applies to people who have big families, applies to people who have low overhead, applies to people who have real significant overhead. It applies to people who may choose, who may feel that they have sufficient amount of disability insurance or your own health insurance policy. I mean, there's a lot of variables, and you can make, under the way the law is now, you can make that assessment for yourself, what you need to protect yourself, and buy that. It's going to be offered to you. If we change that, it won't necessarily be offered anymore, although it may still be out there in the marketplace. We don't know for sure. The other concern thing to point out, and you notice that the testimony people have said, there certainly is a concern by the insurance companies that are in the non-preferred market to offering this because of the reinsurance problem also. And that's why I say I think there's a compromise position here, and that's to exempt those drivers out. Say that for those type of non-preferred drivers, you don't have to make this offer. And leave it in place for the other, almost as a reward to the good drivers out there, is you get extra consumer options. I would support that. I would also support, as I initially made, the deletion of the requirement in the present law that at each renewal they would have to make this offer. And that'd be a simple change in the law. Just say that they shall offer this coverage, but they don't have to keep repeating it over and over, because we've gone through that phase. And as disappointed as I am, I don't think it did work as educationally as I was hoping it was going to work in that. And finally, there's no guarantee anywhere here that any new companies will come to Alaska if we do make this change. There's a chance that a new insurance company may come to Alaska and increase competition, but we know that there's certainly nobody in the room can represent that anybody said, we will come if you do this. And in fact, I don't think it's really absolutely clear that any of them left specifically because of this. There was certainly a reason that people may have articulated for going, but I don't think it was probably the only reason. If they were making money, they would have stayed, too. So those are just some follow-up.
Is Charles McGee still on the line in Anchorage?
Yes, he is.
Mr. McGee, we're up against a time problem here. Could we ask you to make this testimony very brief, please?
Yes, I intend to. My ID card is 033-4797. My name is Charles McGee. I would like to have my driver's license back. I indicated I was for this legislation. On line 13, it indicates there's the word voluntary. And I'd like you to submit the use of documentation.
Could you send it to us, please? Or if you give it to them, folks at the teleconference there, they can pouch it down to us.
Yes, I would make it over the air the fact that Book 18, United States Code 506, indicates that the funds, the money is illegal. I have the right to represent the Regional Treasurer's Bill in the current.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McGee. Okay, did anybody else want to testify on the bill? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Howard Jager, Alaska Independent Insurance Agents. I think it's important that we remember that we're not talking about any and every accident. We're only talking about an accident where the other driver is at fault, not when, if I'm the driver and I'm at fault and I hit another car, uninsured motorist is not a player in my coverage. It's only if another driver hits me then they either have no insurance or they have underinsured coverage. It's not an on an every accident basis.
Okay. Anybody else want to testify?
I don't want to testify. I have a question. Could you explain to me, please, Mr. Chairman, or whoever, that on page 2, that it says, well, beginning page 1, in this subsection, underinsured motor vehicle does not include uninsured motor vehicle. Where does that, everywhere I read, I'm reading both of those. And how does that tie in? I'm not so sure.
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Lincoln, there's a difference between an underinsured motorist and an uninsured motorist. Yes. An uninsured motorist has no coverage whatsoever.
I understand that, but yes. My question is, the title reads uninsured and underinsured, and throughout that subsection it says owners, operators of uninsured and underinsured, and then that section says that this section is not talking about or does not include uninsured, but it speaks to that in the whole section.
Mr. Chairman, that looks like a drafting style, and I don't know the answer to Senator Lincoln.
Okay, why don't we do this? We've got a couple other questions. Why don't we hold the bill until another time, and we will look at that and bring it up at another day, okay? Well, that means the last bill today is HB 439, Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act.
Yeah.
What a cash ship.
Okay, Danielle.
That's the bikes. He keeps turning them on and off.
Last bill, folks. We'll be out of here in 10 minutes.
Yeah. Okay, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and the committee members. My name is Daniela Loper, and I'm the committee aide to the House Judiciary Committee for Representative Brian Porter. HJR 43, UFTA, basically concerns itself, it is the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. It is a uniform law, and basically what does it do? Currently, basically in Alaska law, especially in this area, the laws have not been updated since 1949. It was taken from Oregon. And there have been quite a few changes since 1949 in the bankruptcy legal area and also relationships between creditor and debtor. Particular, in current law, when a transfer is fraudulent, the plaintiff bears the burden of proof in actually proving actual intent to hinder, delay, or defraud creditors. This burden of proof can be extremely hard to prove. And what UFTA does is that it would eliminate the present Alaska necessity of finding actual intent by a property transfer to hinder, delay, or defraud creditor in many situations where transfer is obviously transferring assets solely to keep them out of the reach of the transfer's creditors. And this act renders a transfer made or an obligation incurred without adequate consideration to be constructively fraudulent. And if you can, and I realize that the sexual analysis is quite long, but on page 3, you can take a look that it establishes now for the first time, without having to prove actual intent, three basic areas. And let's see here. The debtor was left by the transfer or obligation with unreasonable small assets for a transaction or the business in which the debtor was engaged. Have you found that? It's on the sexual analysis, page 3. And the debtor intended to incur or believed that the debtor would incur more debts than the debtor would be paid. Basically, what does this all mean? This all means is that no longer does the plaintiff have to prove actual intent.
Why don't you tell us really in English, what does this thing do?
Okay. Basically, in English, in current law, if I transferred, let's say I owed a debt, okay?
let's say $20,000. I didn't want to pay that money. So what I did is I had some money in my bank account, which I could have easily paid for that debt, but I transferred it over to my mother and gave it as a gift. That would be a fraudulent transfer of my money. And so in order for the creditor to take me to court, they'd have to prove actual intent. It's extremely hard to prove in that case. So a lot of creditors are basically just left twiddling their thumbs. What the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act does is it establishes three criteria without having to prove actual intent. And it gives a basis where creditors now are given a little bit more leverage in going after the debtor. That's basically what it does.
Okay. Do we have Mary Ellen Beardsley on the line?
Yes, I do.
Okay, Mary Ellen is an assistant attorney general that has a background in tax and bankruptcy law. And Mary Ellen, what is your opinion of the bill?
The Department of Law is made for this law. We feel it will assist creditors and also the state in collecting debts from debtors who have found new and more imaginative ways of trying to hide their assets. And it definitely is beneficial in that it makes it easier for creditors and harder for debtors to do what they've been doing.
Okay, any questions?
Very briefly, is it your intention to move the bill?
Yes, it does go to judiciary.
I'm a little uneasy about the bill, and it sounds like this is a way for, especially the undoing of the section on remedies of creditors. It allows you to be pretty sloppy in perfecting your security interest in the first place. I'm not sure how that all works, but it seems like it might get in the way of some legitimate, there could be some unknowing parties who are the recipient of some of these transfers that end up finding their assets sucked up back up from underneath them back to a creditor back down the line who didn't perfect his or her interest. Could you at least explain what page 2, lines 28 and 29 do, where it says the assets of the debtor are unreasonably small in relation to a business? Who judges that?
Page 2, line
28 and 29.
Okay. Mary Ellen, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Is the question addressed to me or to
the... if you're prepared, since you're an AG, I'd appreciate your legal opinion of what that says.
It's the exact same bill.
Okay. Refer back to the page and the line again, please.
Page 2, lines 28 and 29, where it says, assets of a debtor are unreasonably small in relation to a business or transaction. What does that mean?
So, let me read the whole thing in context, please.
It's the only question I'll ask. I'll let the chairman move it out.
So you can get out of here. I'm going to get out of my office. Call my insurance.
My background in dealing with commercial transactions in real estate, I would assume that the way I would read that is that it has, the person is engaged in a business and then decides to go into some form of transaction where he or she sells or encumbers, no, I shouldn't say encumbers, where he sells the asset, sells his asset.
Okay, I follow. That's good enough. I follow what you're saying. Thank you.
I have a question as well on the overall bill, and I cannot find it. But how does this bill protect, individuals who are in a partnership, and one person, for some reason, the business failed and at no fault of one of the partners. How does that protect, when you talk about fraudulent, the innocent party?
There's no innocent partners.
Excuse me, are you addressing that question to me?
Yes.
Well,
it doesn't answer my question. I was just reading on, I don't know if you've got it, it's a sectional summary that Ledge Affairs put together, and on page 4, the last paragraph, it talks about the act omits as redundant a provision in the act that makes fraudulent a transfer made or obligation incurred by an insolvent partnership for far less than a fair consideration to the partnership. And then further in the, well, I guess that's still the same, sectional analysis that defines insider and whether the partner is an insider to the individual, the corporation, etc. Well, an insider here is even, it says if the debtor is an is a relative of the debtor.
Correct.
Wow.
Now, you also must realize or take into consideration there are defenses in this act so that, for instance, the transferee, if the transferee was a relative, there are certain defenses. And the creditor does not have just a straight, easy shot at this. There are things that have to be proven. This act does make it a little bit easier in that certain instances will be considered a presumed intent. But there are defenses to that.
Okay, further questions? Good. This is one of those bills where there'll be a lot of no wrecks, but it does throw the Judiciary Committee next.
And they can handle
it. Senator Sharp?
Mr. Chairman, I would move HB 439 Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act out of committee with individual recommendations.
Without objection, it goes out of committee. Danielle, would you tell Brian Porter he's going to be on the floor of the Senate to explain this?
I would love to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And that ends the committee meeting.